The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the New York Times and National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we begin with a question. How do you handle over-tourism? Yeah, the word is over-tourism. Well, many popular tourist destinations have become too popular as far as locals are concerned. Writer Lisa Abben explored this issue, which resulted in an article headlined, Bans, Fees, Taxes, Can Anything Stop Over-Tourism? This appeared in the January 28, 2025 issue of the New York Times. Now, as the editors note, efforts to limit visitors in tourist hotspots have had mixed results at best. Competing interests have a way of impeding attempts to stem the tide. In Dubrovnik, Croatia, for example, tourists overwhelm locals, especially in the summer high season. Now, over the years, numerous regulations have been enacted, yet tourism continues to grow. Now, let's learn more as we begin Lisa Abben's story. This, by the way, was January 28, 2025 of the New York Times. And we began, for years, Dubrovnik, Croatia has been a poster child for over-tourism, with summer visitors vastly outnumbering the local population and the municipal government repeatedly introducing measures to diminish the size and impact of a flood of tourists that turns the historic center into a crowded parking lot of selfie snappers. But you would never know about the negative effects of so many visitors from the Croatian Ministry of Tourism's recent triumphant announcement, noting that arrivals to the city had increased 9% in 2024 compared to 2023. By all parameters, we achieved another record year, the tourism minister, Tonci Glavina, was quoted as saying. In 2024, that was the year in which concerns about overtourism achieved a critical mass in places around the globe, and it sparked protests from Amsterdam to the Canary Islands and triggered new regulations from Iceland to Indonesia. It was also the year in which it became clear just how complicated reducing tourism, once it is unleashed, can be. This year, we'll see even more locations enact measures, but the evidence on how or even whether tourism can be constrained remains scarce. Competing economic interests have a way of impeding attempts to stem the tourist tide. The hard truth is that once over-tourism has arrived, says Rachel Dodds, a professor of tourism management at Toronto Metropolitan University, she says it's exceedingly difficult to turn back the clock. A long-standing problem. As early as 2010, tourism experts observed that some destinations were approaching or had exceeded their carrying capacity. By the middle of the last decade, cities like Amsterdam and Barcelona had begun taking tentative steps to relieve tourism's impacts on infrastructure, housing, and the environment, and quality of life. But it was only after the pandemic, when revenge travel brought the greater number of visitors to more destinations, that efforts to apply the brakes became more widespread. This year, travelers will feel the effects of those efforts. New legislation regulating Airbnbs and other short-term rentals goes into effect in France, the Czech Republic, and Greece, where a 24.5% surge in foreign visitors in 2024 over the previous year is also behind an increased tax up to 20 euros a day for cruise passengers on the islands of Santorini and Mykonos. Now, ports from Ibiza to Juneau, Alaska, are restricting the number of cruise ships that can dock simultaneously, and in Juneau's case, will be cutting back on the number of passengers allowed each day. Bruges, Belgium, has halted new hotel construction, and Amsterdam, after imposing a similar measure in 2024, only to discover that some accommodations were exploiting a loophole, passed another measure in November that prevents them from adding more rooms or beds to their offerings. Now, in Italy, tourists will be limited to 20,000 a day in Pompeii, and new legislation in Florence may prevent tourists from using golf carts to tool around. New Zealand will require visitors to pay a tourist tax of 100 New Zealand dollars, or about 57 U.S. dollars. That's about three times higher than it was for most of last year, while the Galapagos Islands has doubled its fee to $200. In Japan, the mountain town of Ginzan Onsen recently joined Mount Fuji in some streets in Kyoto in restricting tourist numbers. And in South Korea, authorities have imposed a curfew in a historic neighborhood of Seoul to dampen tourist excesses. Will regulations work? Well, the major issue is that for many, many years, we've been utilizing an extractive model of tourism that says numbers at any cost, said Marina Novelli, the director of the Sustainable Travel and Tourism Advanced Research Center at the University of Nottingham. Now we are in a situation where all these kinds of things are being implemented, she says, like restricting numbers and tourist taxes as reactive strategies. Whether these strategies will work remains to be seen. The evidence is spotty and suggests that measures take a long time to have an effect. Barcelona, for example, implemented its first tourist tax in 2012, began restricting short-term rentals in 2015, and capped new hotel construction in 2017. Yet tourists continued to arrive in record numbers through the first third of 2024. It was only at the end of the year that the annual rate of arrivals showed a modest 0.7% decline over 2023. In Amsterdam, which began targeting over-tourism in 2016, arrivals are expected to climb to 26 million in 2026. Curbing numbers is not always the primary aim. Capping short-term rentals, for example, is frequently posed as a solution to housing shortages, while tourist taxes can be intended to offset the strain that over-tourism can place on resources. Some places like New Zealand and Hawaii are trying to do it as more of a regenerative or stewardship measure, Ms. Dodd says, while in others, like Venice, it is punitive, slapping a tax and thinking it would persuade people not to come. Set an amount roughly equivalent to a coffee and a cornetto, Venice's 5 euro fee introduced last year was hardly dissuasive. Venice seems to have reached the same conclusion. This year, the rate doubles to 10 euros. Now, will that have more of an impact? According to Co Cohens, a professor of urban tourism at N. Holland University for the Applied Sciences, no one knows. I can tell you for sure that 5 euros wouldn't work, he said, but we don't have enough data to show how high it has to go to work. In other measures in Venice have also come up short. The city recently began diverting cruise ships from its historic center. While the initiative may lessen environmental damage, it has not had any discernible effect on passenger numbers. In the fall of 2024, Venice predicted a 9% increase for the year over 2023, thanks to its newly distributed ports. In fact, restricting passengers in one area may channel over-tourism to another. It's like a waterbed, Mr. Cohen said. By spreading the people out to other places, you potentially increase over-tourism issues. New York City began enforcing a pre-existing ban on short-term rentals last year. The measure, which some experts correlate to 2024's 7% increase in hotel rates over the previous year, has sent tourists to surrounding areas where the rentals are legal. Now, New Jersey has become the fastest-growing market for Airbnb demand in the United States, according to the analytics site AirDNA. Yet it does not appear to have reduced the number of tourists to New York itself. The city expects to surpass its previous record of 66.6 million in 2019 by 1.4 million in 2025. Dubrovnik in Copenhagen and the resistance to limits. The greatest obstacle to solving overtourism may be the lack of consensus that it actually is a problem. As a source of revenue and employment, globally, tourism generated a record $1.6 trillion in 2024. Travel is an engine for economic growth. Because of that role, most attempts to limit tourism face opposition. Witness the recent decision to repeal Bali's planned moratorium on new hotel construction. Mato Frankovic, the mayor of Dubrovnik, has experienced that resistance after he reduced the number of cruise ships, restricted rentals in the old town, and cut the number of tables and chairs in outdoor cafes by 30%, and the number of souvenir stands by 70%. International and local businesses rebelled. The opposition was saying, "I was going to ruin the city," Mr. Frankovic said. He persevered. This year, the city will reduce the number of taxis, introduce apps that regulate tour bus arrivals, and direct visitors to alternative sites at peak times, and enact national legislation that requires apartment owners in multi-dwelling buildings to obtain the consent from 80% of other residents before they can rent their apartment. Yet even when municipal or regional authorities are determined to make changes, they can find themselves pitted against the national government that prioritizes economic growth. Take Copenhagen. The city council approved a tourist tax in 2024 as a nice way to prevent us from ending up like Barcelona, says Rasmus Steenberger, a member of the municipal government. But the national government, which is currently expanding Copenhagen's airport and recently announced a plan to increase tourism revenue to 200 billion kroner per year, that's about 28 billion U.S. dollars, from 152 billion kroner by 2030, rejected the proposed tourist tax. Searching for a real solution. Such conflict is why many experts believe more profound changes are needed. Ms. Dodds of Toronto Metropolitan University said that a solution requires rethinking the definition of success. UN tourism still measures success by the number of arrivals, which essentially is perpetuating the problems of overtourism, she said. So the conversation needs to be, how do we change the metrics of success? There are signs that new metrics are emerging. Both Bruges and Norway pulled tourism advertising campaigns last year, and some cruise and tour companies have voluntarily scratched Santorini and Mykonos from the itineraries for 2025 and 2026. Now, but with new international arrivals globally expected to grow 12.4% in 2025 over their 2019 levels, overtourism seems likely to spread. I'm not sure there is a solution, said Ms. Novelli of the University of Nottingham, unless it's people taking responsibility and saying, you know what, I don't need to see Venice. I'm not going to go. Interesting proposition there, right? We'll probably hear more about that issue in future episodes. Well, next we're going to head to Africa for writer Tim Neville's story, Walking with Rhinos in Zimbabwe. Now, everyone benefits. Now, the article appeared in the January 31st, 2025 issue of the New York Times. Now, a subhead reads, "On the fringes of an African game park, an ambitious project brings together tourists, local communities, and white rhinos emerging from the brink of extinction." Now, let's go with the story. And this was January 31st. Daybreak filtered through spindly stands of terminalia trees, and the windshield glowed. It was September in northwest Zimbabwe, and the morning carried the lingering chill of an African winter. I rode at the head of a convoy that had been rumbling through the night. Campfires flickered eerily from the forest, where truckers ferrying copper out of Zambia and the Democratic Republic of Congo had stopped to rest. A towering man with a slate-colored eyes yawned at the wheel. Mark Butcher, a Zimbabwean in his 60s, had led the convoy for more than 14 hours from the grassy Lodeveld of southeast Zimbabwe toward the fringes of Hwange National Park in the northeast. Hwange is a wildlife lover's dream, and Mr. Butcher, who was once a ranger there and now manages Mbelo, a small safari company that helps villages near the park benefit from tourism conservation, knows it well. Leopards, lions, Cape buffalo, and more than 50,000 elephants are among the animals that roam the 5,660-square-mile expanse. But there is one animal among the big five that has long been absent, the rhinoceros. Mr. Butcher was in the process of changing that. Tucked in the middle of the convoy was a six-wheel drive truck carrying two wild drugged white rhinoceroses that had been donated from a private reserve 280 miles south of Harare, that's Zimbabwe's capital. There, a philanthropic American hedge fund manager has spent more than 25 years creating one of the world's most successful rhino population programs, or repopulation programs, I should say, expanding the herd to several hundred from a few dozen. For decades, only a few of these extraordinary mammals could be found in the country at all, and by 2002, Africa's rhinos had been poached to the brink of extinction for their horns and the myth that they had curative powers. Now, thanks to Mr. Butcher, countless locals and a team of ecologists, biologists, and veterinarians, these two white rhinos were on their way to a new home in their historical habitat on the opposite end of the country. The rhinos would not live in Hawangi proper, but on an adjacent community-owned land where locals had been trained and hired to care for them. By encouraging visitors to venture out of the park to see rhinos and giving locals a stake in the animals' well-being, the project is supposed to bring jobs, services, and life-changing benefits to villages long relegated to the economic periphery. I spent a week checking out this ambitious community tourism project that Mr. Butcher has worked on for more than a decade. The fate of that project, the Community Rhino Conservation Initiative, hinged on the two drugged rhinos trundling with us through the night. A new home. The full brunt of the sun filled the truck as our convoy approached Malebu, a company at the edge of the park. Ahead of us, clusters of tidy mud huts sprouted from neatly raked yards of sand. Scores of school children had gathered alongside the dirt road, each one wearing a vivid blue uniform and waving a white flag that read, "Welcome, Rhinos!" Here, sandwiched between Hawangi and this village of about 80 families, the newly created 2,500-acre Malebu Rhino Sanctuary would be the rhinos' home. To ease their transition, the animals would be released into an enclosed area within the sanctuary, where they would spend several months watched over by armed guards. If all went well, within a year, the rhinos would be fully acclimated to their surroundings, and thanks to the guards' constant presence, used to humans. Then visitors would be able to enter the sanctuary for a fee and walk with the rhinos as they grazed. Mr. Butcher zipped away from the other vehicles in the convoy, parked under a thorn tree, and climbed out of the truck. He said, "Unatanda umkambo," he bellowed to the students in Nobeli, a Bantu language. "Do you like the rhinos?" And the children burst with glee. The convoy rumbled ahead of us toward the sanctuary, giving everyone a glimpse of the rhino crates, and the kids went silent, as they'd been taught, so as not to disturb the animals. A short while later, Mr. Butcher and I headed to the Malebu Sanctuary, where the rhinos' cages were being carefully unloaded. By late morning, village dignitaries and travelers on safari had made their way to the holding pen, or boma. We all watched in amazement as the rhinos cautiously emerged from their cages. Among the observers was Vusa Nkwobi, a guide who grew up in the fringes of the park. He was clearly moved. "You can talk about cheetahs, you can talk about lions, but man, rhinos are special," he said. "We are very happy you are here." Well, that night I settled into my tent in Bomani, one of Mbelo's four properties in the area. The one had campus wall tents, built next to a warding hole frequented by hippos and elephants, and I curled up in my bed and fell asleep to distant, unknown creatures calling and screaming in the dark. Well, the next day, I hopped into Mr. Butcher's truck with other Bomani guests. We were headed to the village of Ngamo, another community that abuts the park, but it was only about 8 miles away, but felt like a world apart from Nluvu. It was in Ngamo that the Community Rhino Initiative began and where the nascent tourism endeavor now flourishes. Our land cruiser mounts down ruts of Kalahari and sand and brittle grass. Mr. Butcher honked, and students came running out of the woodlands. "Gotta, gotta, gotta," Mr. Butcher shouted. "Jump in." Kids sprinted to the truck, climbed into the back. Within moments, they were singing call and response songs about love and cowardice. You're lazy, they shouted through peals of laughter to schoolmates too far away to hitch a ride. Driver, shift gears, they said, cackling, go faster. Well, thatched-roofed homes with mud walls were scattered around the scrublands. We stopped outside Ngamo Primary School, a yellow concrete building with a red metal roof. In the courtyard, the kids sang a song about their beautiful school and recited the Lord's Prayer. The headmaster, Progress Sibanda, led me to a classroom painted in bright, cheery colors with desks, chalkboards, and shelves of textbooks from Oxford University Press. Mr. Nkube, the guide, had attended the school only a few years ago when it had four walls but no roof. We are very happy you are here, Mr. Sibanda said to our group. In 2022, Mr. Butcher teamed up with Ngamo's leaders for a pilot project that introduced a different pair of white rhinos into a sanctuary that was much smaller than Imluvu's, the 420-acre Ngamo Rhino Sanctuary. The goal was to prove that villagers could protect the animals and engage with travelers. A few years later, the project has accomplished both, with more than 2,500 foreign visitors arriving in total, each of whom paid up to $180 to see and hike with the rhinos. So far, those fees have pumped about $100,000 into a community fund, an enormous amount for a village that once relied on only subsistence farming and had virtually no money in circulation. Now, Ngamo has a medical clinic serving 90 homesteads. An outdoor market sells local handicrafts, tapestries, baskets, and ornaments carved from nuts with rhinos etched on their sides. The school now has a roof, and the Ngamo Lions Youth Soccer Club plays on a field nearby. Imluvu, on the other hand, has none of this, other than a school in deep need of repairs. It may soon, though, thanks to the new rhinos. Everyone wants to see the Big Five, and with the rhinos, that creates the opportunity for them to venture into the villages. Mazai Moyo, a head man and carpenter in Ngamo, told me as we talked in his kitchen. His wife, Sipui, sat next to him below earthen shelves holding neat rows of yellow plates and blue caps. Everyone benefits, Mr. Moyo said. Running with the cobras. Over the next few days, I did some traditional safari activities from my base near Bomani, and a few untraditional ones, too. Two Midwesterners on a tour through the southern Africa invited me to join them on their game viewing drive in and around Hwange, where we paused to watch kaleidoscopic birds like lilac-breasted rollers and swallow-tailed bee-eaters flitter among the thorn trees. A journey of giraffes ambled off into the distance. A lioness emerged from a blue bush with two fuzzy cubs near the tracks for the Elephant Express. An open-air train, which rumbled past one of the few working sections of the unfinished 19th-century Cape to Cairo Railway. Elsewhere in the park, you can pedal a mountain bike along trails to search for lions with armed guards in hand, and there are bunkers at watering holes for spying on thirsty fauna. Toward the end of my stay, I spent a few hours with Daniel Terblanchi, a soldier who now lives near Hwange and trains and manages a community wildlife protection unit. The Cobras staff with local young men who spend 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, guarding the rhinos with automatic rifles from only a few feet away. The idea is guard them so heavily that it becomes a suicide mission for any poacher, Mr. Terblanchi said. Visiting with the Cobras is enlightening. You can go on morning runs with them and tour the headquarters to see how the operation works. You can even go on exercises with the Cobras and bound through the bush carrying a small caliber assault rifle, firing at paper targets hidden among the trees. I was horrible at it, but it drove home a point. The danger these guys face is very real, Mr. Terblanchi said. Many of the Cobras were once poachers themselves, he added, walking with the rhinos. That afternoon, I finally got my chance to walk with the rhinos in Ngamo. The two males brought to Imluvu were adjusting well, but it would be months before they would be habituated to humans. Along with some guests from Bomani, I climbed into Mr. Butcher's rig for the drive to the Ngamo Sanctuary. There, the two pilot project rhinos, Tusa and Kusasa, were sleeping by the gate. When we arrived, they slowly got up and ambled off into the plains. I watched them spar like teenage boys jockeying for pizza before they started hovering up on the grass. Two cobras followed close behind. For 20 minutes, I talked with Tulsa and then Kusasa. At times, they were no more than 20 feet away, close enough to see their leathery skin flicker under the flies and to hear their snorts. I've had close encounters with grizzly bears and gray whales, magical yet terrifying experiences both, but even those could not compare. There are communities all along Hawage now clamoring for rhinos, each hoping to jumpstart its own tourism offerings. Mr. Butcher and local leaders have already set in motion plans for at least two more sanctuaries to open over the next 4 years. Mr. Butcher hopes that one day this corner of Zimbabwe could have 1,000 rhinos roaming free, a sustainable breeding population. That's the Holy Grail, he said. Well, we end our journey today on Armchair Traveler with a brief excerpt from Terry Ward's story, Inside the NFL's Football Factory. Now, this appeared in the February 2025 issue of National Geographic. Over 100 million fans will be tuning in to watch opposing quarterbacks sling perfectly spiraling passes downfield during Super Bowl 49 in February. The big game, of course, an annual tradition, and hinges on a design that has changed little since it originated back in the 19th century. The size, shape, and texture of NFL footballs have stayed the same for more than 100 years, with only one exception. They're technically not pigskins because manufacturers have shifted from using pig bladders to cowhide leather. Fans may not know that bit of trivia, but it still amazes physicists. It's a historical accident that the original design still perfectly suits the modern needs of the sport, said Ribendra Mehta, the former chief of the Experimental Aerophysics Division at NASA's Ames Research Center in California. Compared to a baseball, a football is more aerodynamic shaped by design. That's probably because the football is not actually a ball, but a prolate spheroid, oblong with pointed ends that make it easier to grip. The manner in which the air flows around that spheroid also helps it travel great distances. But no one knows the details of what makes each football so aerodynamic and so durable better than those in charge of manufacturing the NFL's footballs. At the Wilson Sporting Goods Company factory in Ada, Ohio, roughly 120 craftspeople hand-make that time-tested design. Here's what happens behind the scenes. Inside the facility, large leather sheets from Chicago's Horween Leather Company are stamped to create a pebbly feel. They are embossed with tiny W's at intervals to ensure the authenticity of the material. To achieve an oblong shape, the leather is cut into four individual panels that are leaf-shaped and tapered at both ends. These are sewn together inside out, which makes the seam invisible and more durable. Then the leather is steamed so that it becomes soft enough to turn right side out. To make the job easier, a craftsperson called a turner uses a pneumatic hammer to make the pointed ends more pliable before the football is reversed forcibly by hand on a metal pole. An experienced turner can do this in about 30 seconds. An air bladder is then inserted, and the football is laced together by hand. Nearly completed balls are placed inside a pressurized chamber, and that casts them into the uniform shape that you and I get to see every time we watch a game. Well, all of that works in the quarterback's favor once a ball is thrown. Characteristics of the authorized football surface, including pebbling, stitching of the panels, the laces, allow airflow to stay in contact longer. And that thin layer of air skimming past the bowed surface is referred to as the boundary layer. And that's where its design shines. While the surrounding air may not directly hug a football's curves all the way around, it does continue over the apex of the ball, resulting in a minimal wake and less drag. And that's different from purely spherical baseballs, where the air makes a connection with only half the ball, creating more of a wake and a drag. So watch out for those curveballs. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's edition of Armchair Traveler. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next week. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And I remind you, the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have comments or questions, direct them to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.